It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember. I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here! Tonight, let us make them remember. We are not afraid!
No fear here on Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, here in Phoenix, Arizona, from the BEA beautiful studios of Freedoms of the Nest, freedomsphoenix.com. Now, we got a special show for you today. I've been looking forward to doing this, and let me tell you how this came about. On our way to Libertopia on Thursday, I got a call from Jordan Page. A lot of you know we're all good friends of Jordan Page, and love his activism, and he goes around the country and he gets to meet a lot of people, and he's very excited about making sure that I got introduced to Darcy Van Orden. Now, in Utah, she is the chair of the Republican Liberty Caucus there. Now, she's a family rights advocate in opposition to the man taking away the children. Now, what has happened is I was immediately interested in doing this, and we were hoping to get her on some of the shows that we were going to do at Libertopia, but Libertopia is just, man, it's a party. You know, guess what? I was on vacation. So what we wanted to do is today, we were doing some interviews and so on. Darcy was kind enough to come on short notice today because I wanted to get this relationship started because I know how important it is to a lot of people. Now, this is what's going on. Around the country, there is increasingly a presence of the government inside the family, inside your walls of your home. Once you get the government involved, once a form is created, once a check on checkbox is not checked on some form of somebody with a shiny badge, or they don't even have to have a badge, it's just with the government, and children are involved, any kind of government services that are involved, they are there to stay and they never go away. Now, there's a reason.
Absolutely.
Now, I need to talk to Darcy about this. Now, Darcy Van Orden, there is a reason for this. It is an ever-growing, ever-present intrusion into the family because they can, and I need to know how it is that they can. Please, help us understand what's going on.
Okay, thanks so much for having me on the show. This is such an issue that I'm very passionate about because I guess as I've become, I'm a Tea Party activist, and I found myself in a situation where, you know, the thought of fighting the federal government is this huge, you know, thing that you feel like you're never going to win, you know, because they're always growing, they're always, you know, in your face, and they're always taking more of your liberty away. And over the last year, actually, a mother reached out to me because she saw that I was very heavily active in our state legislature. I was actually fighting against, several pieces of legislation here in the state of Utah where, you know, basically it was my belief they were trying to create a police state with a number of these bills. And based on seeing that activism, a mother reached out, kind of shared their story and their situation and alerted to me to this issue. And so over the last year, I've been working on this and becoming more aware of what's happening. And I'll be honest with you, I'm completely blown away by what has taken place in this nation over the past 20 years, based and out of the creation of DCFS, which I'm sure maybe in somebody's, you know, mind and imagination initially was started under the premise of a good role to protect, you know, the innocent, those who can't protect themselves.
Okay, now when you're going to throw around initials and acronyms and so on, you got to define that. DCFS stands for what?
Absolutely, Department of Child and Family Welfare Services.
Okay, now a lot of us understand and know about the phrase Child Protective Services, CPS. Now, where does that come from?
Well, basically, that's just a department underneath a subdivision of DCFS.
Okay, now let's go ahead and let's map this out as well as we can inside our heads here on radio. Now, we have the department, right off the bat, you know you're in trouble, of Children and Family Welfare Services. What gives them their jurisdiction? Now, you're saying that that department is common amongst all 50 states, and if all 50 states has the same department, I'll guarantee you there's a line of money coming from the federal government.
Absolutely. Just in the state of Utah, basically, they have a $157 million budget to implement their various services relationship to the family welfare, children, adoption, foster care, abuse. All of these things all fall under that subheading.
Okay. Now, you got to let's go ahead and map it down. We got, is that the highest, the Department of Child Family Welfare Services? Is that where the main money starts there and then filtered down, or is there one above that?
One above that would be Health and Human Services.
I'm sorry?
I would say Health and Human Services is probably what it probably falls under. I know that's what it falls under here in Utah, is, you know, all of this, you know, can fall under Health and Human Services, HHS.
Okay, so let's go ahead and make it clear for me and everybody, because if I understand it, probably everybody else will, because I'm done. Okay. We have Department of Child and Family Welfare Services, that is not the highest one. There is a Department of Human whatever
I would just say that's probably the committee that it falls under, but I would say DCFS is kind of the pinnacle where the decisions are made. So I'm just saying that's the committee it falls under, is Health and Human Services.
Well, see, the reason I want to dial this in is because it always winds up, you know, where the money is. Because nothing
Absolutely.
Is done. I give you a perfect example for a lot of people to be able to understand. If outside right now I see a crime, somebody's taking my car, they're stealing it, I call the government and I say, hey, man, there's somebody stealing my car right now. I'm looking at it. I'm watching it happen. They have absolutely no concern. They're like, well, you know, we'll take a report over the phone. You file with the insurance and, you're not insured. Life sucks. You know, if you are, fine. Here's the number. So you go, okay, so it's a protect and serve thing. That's just, you're just paperwork guys. You know, somebody gets shot, killed. You're just here to draw the chalk line. Okay, I get it. So what happens is, if you were to say, hey, I smelled marijuana. You know, that guy looks like, man, I think he's a drug dealer. You know, I think he was smoking marijuana while he was stealing my car. Here come the helicopters. And the reason is because there's financial incentives from the federal government for certain types of crimes. So what I'm looking for is there is some incentive. And when you say for the children, I'll guarantee there's some kind of something money for the children. So there has to be some kind of an incentive, one, for this department to even exist, certainly replicated across 50 states. Then it goes down into various different levels of how that money is dispersed. Now, you can get in all the details and the corruption and who benefits and all that, and I'm sure we will, but I just want to map out where the money is coming from first, so we kind of get an idea of how influential this is from a central plan of Mordor on the Potomac. So, okay. So we have Department of Child and Family Welfare Services, and for today's show, right below that or as part of that is Child Protective Services. Is that there's no other insulating factor in between those?
No, this is just a subdivision of the Division of Child and Family Services.
Okay, so now we got a map on it. Now, there is a budget line in the federal government to a particular state that says Department of Child and Family Welfare Services shall get X amount of $1 billion or whatever it is, and that's dispersed out based on, I guess, population or whoever's got the best congressman to give me my money. And it goes to the state, and then they fund the various different departments of. Part of that is Child Protective Services. Is that where we're at?
Correct.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So now Child Protective Services, they got a job to do. What is that job?
basically their responsibility is to see oversight of, you know, making sure that, you know, things are well, that crimes are not taking place within the family. And then I feel like they've broadened their jurisdiction much further, because I would argue that we have them intruding in the lives of families where they should not be, where crimes have not been taking place. And I guess if people understand the law and the responsibility of the police a little bit better, I think that they would have to be, they should be far less intrusive. I mean, technically, the responsibilities of our police officer, most people don't realize, it's not to prevent crime per se. It's their responsibility is to, when a crime occurs, to investigate it and to basically, you know, provide assistance, you know, in that process where in a court of law, you know, reparations can be made for violations of people's life, liberty, and property. So here we have a situation where DCFS, because they are given so much unbridled power, the attorney for DCFS, of course, is the attorney general in every state. So you've got, you know, basically they get the protection of that. They operate, you know, with this omnipotent power and this force and coercion, unlike anything else I can look to taking place. Because basically my question is, you know, if under the threat and duress that you would have your children taken, what would you not do?
I don't know. You got me by, sensitive areas. So this, the one, when you say, you know, the one thing I'm stuck on, I wrote it down, is you say, you know, our justice system and our government, they're there, you know, reparations and so on. That's, you know, it might be nice if that was the way it worked,
well,
but, you know,
If provide justice where your rights are violated. And when I say rights, I mean, you know, violations of my life, liberty, and property. And I think that should be where, you know, it ends. But unfortunately, we both know that, you know, they love to intrude and they want to be involved in everything.
Okay,
and
now let's walk this through. I mean, you know, imagine this. You know, I'm a, you know, a libertarian raising my family. I now have two grandkids. My children are 22. Today is my youngest daughter's birthday. She's 22. Yeah, my oldest is 26. So I got two boys, two girls. As we raise them, and being a libertarian, I'm going, look, man, let me tell you one thing. I just tell you this. Now, I don't know what they're telling you in your private school and everything, but you call the government on anything, you call the government on dad being mean to me, you know, or you call the government on your friends, your neighbors, your this or that. You involve the government, man, you just need to understand what happens. So we would discuss
Absolutely.
These things and so on. And, of course, I'm running for office, and we have all that. So we never really had that kind of problem. They're good kids. But, you know, any of their friends or anyone that they've known or anyone that's had a child or anything, the second you call the government, they get involved, they never go away. And I'm wondering how it is that what we're discussing here is they didn't just pop up or show up. Something happened. What's the criteria by which they open a file and start getting involved?
Well, basically, they get these anonymous tips all the time, which is what, you know, concerns me, because, you know, you don't really know the situation by which, you know, you came on their radar. But basically, it could be something, you know, as simple as, you know, I know my girlfriend told me that she was, you know, at the hair salon, and she went to pick up her daughter, and she went to pick her up under her arm, and her arm went limp. The child went limp because she didn't want to be picked up, and so she actually pulled on her arm pretty hard. And so, you know, those people actually contacted the police and got her license plate number. And, you know, soon after she gets home after getting her hair done, people are knocking on her door, police officer, to basically inspect the children because, you know, a person felt that she seemed like an abusive mother. And
okay, now,
so
now
I,
when this happens, now, is that all of it? Is it discretion of the officer? He looks at me, okay, fine, boom, done? Or is there, it's in your permanent record?
Well, I don't know all the details by which they maintain a database, but I would imagine that something is left somewhere where basically, you know, there were allegations, and I don't, it may remain there. I can't really say for sure. I'd have to, you know, basically talk with a police officer. But in a lot of these situations that I'm finding as I'm working with a lot of these parents, you know, the police, you know, they get, you know, DCFS gets an anonymous tip, and basically then they're showing up at their doors. And the problem is with the unbridled power that they've had and they possess, I mean, they basically, you are guilty unless by some miracle you're able to beat the system and their charges, because basically the system's totally backwards. It's not like, you know, if we were actually in a criminal court, you would actually have a jury of your peers. You would have due process. You would actually have to use clear and convincing evidence to find you guilty of these crimes. And it is a crime to commit abuse to your children. So for me, I have a big problem with the fact that, you know, they're not actually having these hearings in a criminal court. If there was in a criminal court of law, and everything would be out in the open. But unfortunately, they hold these court hearings, you know, in near secrecy. They actually, in a lot of cases I've heard, you know, they're not even recording the ongoings of what's said and what's happening. You don't have a jury. You just have, of course, the judge. And the judges allow hearsay evidence. And, you know, the threshold by which you can be found guilty, you know, is very flimsy.
You know, this is something that I've heard discussed before during campaigns. Oh, it must have been 10 years ago when this started becoming a big issue here in Arizona. And the argument was from libertarian candidates were, this should be part of law enforcement. This is the local police. This is assault. This is, you know, things that should
exactly.
be in our criminal justice system.
Let the sheriff show up, because that is exactly his domain. This is a crime. And so why don't we allow an investigation and allow, you know, them to handle this? Where it's really unnecessary to have this whole separate, you know, division by which these people are basically from all the indications to me, and based on the families I worked with, which, you know, we've got hundreds of families now, you know, suffering from these issues, and here locally in Utah. I mean, I would argue this is on point with, you know, the Salem witch trials in a lot of ways, because basically you have DCFS. They go in there, they falsify reports. I've heard time and time again, you know, the CPS workers, the caseworkers, they're lying, you know, about what they witnessed, what they saw. You know, basically we have a situation by which they allow hearsay, and you are guilty unless by some vast miracle you're able to find your way out of the system. But I definitely think that between the federal the federal incentive through Title IV-E funding, by which basically it's set up in a way where the goal then becomes to remove children from homes because there's a monetary incentive.
Okay, let's go ahead and talk about that, because we have had local instances here and people that we know going the one I'm more familiar with was an officer came and falsified a report. Ah, they were so drunk they could hardly stand. And then went through, and it was proven that they lied. And it was,
that the police lied?
Yes. No, I'm like, wow. Well, they capitulated. You know, they went to arbitration and kind of, you know, whatever. But the thing is that I'm wondering, they settled with her, and it's a long story. But the point is I'm going, there is an incentive somewhere. There has to be some kind of pat on the back. You get an award for. There is some kind of quota. There's something that gives these, even line officers and the Child Protective Services and this government agency, some kind of incentive. Now, let's go ahead and talk about that. Now, you were brushing on the fact that from the federal government, there is money that is given to local municipalities and or the state departments here for what? How do they get additional monies for removing children from home?
Because basically under Title IV-E funding, the federal government reimburses the state per child removed. And unfortunately, the state can receive even additional bonuses on top by completing this within a certain time frame. So they can get an additional bonus if within 1 year from removing a child, they can actually have that child adopted out to a to a non-family member. So basically to a stranger. There's a reward if they can adopt that child within 1 year out to a stranger, and it's completely demonic and disgusting and insane that that's how they have this system set up. I mean, basically they have it set up to break up the family.
Okay, now let's go ahead and talk about this. Let's walk this through more slowly, because the case that I was talking to, because this weekend when we were at Libertopia, I was talking to people saying that you and I had talked, and there was, and a lot of people came up and said, let me tell you my story, let me tell you my story, let me tell you my story. And one of it, she actually had to sue. She sued them, and I'm not sure if it was, I'm sure it was some kind of civil action. And that's where the police department kind of, you know, we're just going to, you know, we're just make go away. And I'm going, okay, so these incentives to do this come in blocks from the federal government? Are they tied to per incident? And why do you think it is that they would be rewarding for taking a child out of the family? And it can't be like a grandparent or something like that. They're going to give them a reward for that. Somebody lobbied for that. Somebody was asking for that to be included. Who are these people?
Well, you know, I don't know who all these people are, the lobbyists back there in Washington, D.C., but I must say they don't have families and children's best interest at heart. That's
is there
for
a department? Is there a private agency that gets a commission for brokering the deal for adoption?
You know, I'm not aware of that scenario, but basically they are paying on a per-incident basis. So the higher the headcount, the more money the state is ultimately receiving. And so, you know, unfortunately, that's perverse because, you know, they just feel like, well, we got to remove more children if we want to have more money in the system.
No, we see this all the time. There are judges in Pennsylvania and how is it, Wilkes-Barre Scranton area, because I used to live there for a time. I remember there was a judge there that was getting kickbacks for sending children into juvenile detention, and because the private company made money. The more he sent, the more money they made, the more he got. And he eventually went to jail finally. But, you know, this goes on and on and on. There's somebody somewhere that's making money for this. So if I track that down, it's always some forced government-regulated, mandated drug treatment program. Well, there's somebody making money. There's somebody that's, you know, brokering the deal for the adoption of the children to go in. There's somebody making money. And if this happens and anywhere, it's happening everywhere because the incentives are the same.
It absolutely is happening everywhere. In fact, we held a what we call gov abuse nationwide protest back in August, where everywhere, you know, in all states across the nation, we're protesting DCFS and this entire system, because I do believe that there is collusion, because the way that they disperse the funds across that they're receiving DCFS, they do spread some of the money across to the police departments, to, you know, to the, you know, judicial branches, the lower, you know, juvenile court system. And then the other big issue and arena becomes the service providers, because it's my belief that basically they developed a system where they have their go-to service providers. When I say go-to service providers, I'm referring to the therapists who meet with the children and decide, are they, have they been abused or not? You may, or the therapist that meet with parents and say, does that parent seem to have a mental problem, disorder? You know, are they functioning? So if, then you have custody evaluators who also make money along the way. You've got, you know, foster homes. I mean, you've got a whole host of people who feed off the system in addition to the attorneys. You know, so basically this is a money-making mechanism, because what people don't realize is parents who get caught in the middle of this, they find themselves having to pay for all the following. Of course, for their own attorney, unless they get a, you know, a court-appointed attorney, which are basically worthless. They work for the state and help keep the state's interest at heart. But basically parents get stuck paying their own attorney. Then they've got to pay for foster care if their child, in fact, does get put in foster care. They've got to pay for if they require that parent to have supervised visits with their child, they make them pay for that. If the guardian ad litem is assigned, which they often are, the guardian ad litem is technically the child, the attorney for the child that represents their interest. They have to pay for that gardening of items, whatever, however many hours they end up billing them. I mean, so when all in all, when it's all said and done, I mean, this is so much about money more than anything. And then you add on top of all those people who are making money in the system, you add the fact of the matter is the state will be receiving more funding through the Title IV E funds if they can effectively remove a child and adopt them out to non-family.
Wow. Okay, now your other positions in Utah there is your chair of the Republican Liberty Caucus, and you're a member of Campaign for Liberty. I'm sure you're probably a Ron Paul supporting kind of individual. And I'm looking for what kind of response are you getting from the traditional Republicans that you associate with? You know, they're like, yay, team, go. Are they part of the problem? Being in Utah, you have a heavy Mormon influence there. Are they, you know, milking this? Is it just another government program that they're benefiting from? Are they in opposition to it? What's the political climate where you're at?
I don't think there's any sweeping statement. I mean, people are people. They have different opinions. I will say this. People, because there is a higher, first and foremost, there are more children in Utah because, you know, Mormons believe in lots of children, and so there's just a lot more children here. There is a higher rate of abuse by the DCFS, more children in the system here than I've found in other states. I will say this, because of that, we're finding that 1 in 5 families are affected by DCFS. As a result of that, the families, people who are familiar and have had the unfortunate, they've been unfortunate enough to have to deal with DCFS, I think all of them know full well that it's problematic, that it's decimating the family, it's anti-family, it's a very bad situation. And so I have received, you know, a lot of, people reach out to me and say, oh my goodness, let me tell you a story. You know, I have completely been affected by this. This is a horrific situation. I know full well there's problems. You know, we've got to do something about it. But then I do see some from a lot of mainstream Republicans that I feel like in a lot of ways they're your typical people that they just think that automatically anybody in a position of authority is there for a reason and that they're making the right judgment call. And so I do find in some cases where I'm posting about some of these stories that people are actually coming on the defense. Well, oh, if they took that child, if they took those children away, the parents must have been bad parents. You know, and so I do get frustrated when I see that people have this, you know, very statist mentality when they're like, well, if the state steps in, then there must have been a problem. You know, people aren't just harassed.
If you're going to have an advocacy of somebody with a shiny badge and uniform and an always available gun to get involved in something, I certainly would advocate that it be local and that the local police be in charge and that they're answerable and accountable to the people that they are supposed to serve and protect. But when you have a central plan, you know, from the central authority in Washington, D.C., dictating money and how it's used in this social and economic engineering inside the family, once that starts, it never stops, and it's never for the purposes of the child. It's always to serve the state. And I just wonder, has anyone advocated that? I mean, are people saying, you know, the proper role of government is certainly to be more local and not to have this? Who's that person? I mean, I would imagine I'm looking for, who are your allies?
Well, I'm finding more and more, I've been surprised by, there are some people whom I thought at the legislature would be more in my corner and wanting to ready to fight this, and then other people surprised me who stepped up to the plate. I'll be honest with you, I'm running several pieces of legislation, actually with a wonderful lady here locally, a Representative Christine Watkins. She's a Democrat in Carbon County. She's found herself in this situation where her county has like the highest, you know, per capita, you know, DCFS involvement almost anywhere in the state. And so as parents come to her with horror story after horror story, she's very frustrated by the system. She's had enough and she's ready to take them on. And so I can't tell you, I had this meeting with her and I tell you what, I talked about all these various bills I wanted to run. And it was like, you know, every bill I said, could we do this? Could we run a bill like this? And it was like, absolutely, absolutely, absolutely. I swear to you, I've never had that kind of experience with a legislator where it was like, you know, you want to run a bill? I will write it. I will do it. This is what we should do. And she is absolutely ready and willing to take it on. Several other legislators have reached out to me as I've brought more media attention to one of the most recent cases that I'll talk about here in a minute. They've started to kind of be like, well, what's going on? How does this work? Tell me what you know about this. You know, what can we do about it? And so I am feeling very hopeful from the standpoint of, I do have people who are in my corner, and as I'm bringing more awareness to this issue, that I think virtually people suffer in silence with this issue. And so I am so glad that now that I've been able to go on ABC4 on TV and discuss about this issue. I do the Darcy Report on my friend's radio show, and we've talked about this issue, and listeners have called in and they said, oh my goodness, let me tell you my story. You know, people have been reaching out to me and saying, I need help. You know, what can I do? And so I'm in the process of trying to incorporate so I can create kind of my own advocacy consulting group where I can retain good attorneys, get them to do some pro bono work. I want to get some legal assistance from, I want to reach out to all the local law schools and say, get some interns to start working on these cases, and hand an intern to a case and say, let's do something about this. Because what I find disheartening the most is I feel like they target people at poverty level because it's so much easier to take these people's children away, and because they just don't know how to fight it. They get these court-appointed attorneys, they give them bad legal advice that are basically working at, you know, as an extension for the state. And, you know, I really want to take on this battle because I do feel like I can't fight and turn around Washington, D.C., but what I can do is I can reach out and help these families finally get somebody in their corner where they have everything stacked against them. They've got the guardian of litem working against them. They've got, you know, DCFS working against them and the caseworkers. They've got custody evaluators and therapists that are in the back corner, you know, basically saying everything DCFS wants them to say. And then I'm also finding corruption amongst judges who basically, or more than anything, just don't have the backbone to step up to DCFS. I tell you what, there was a, you know, I found that, you know, kind of in researching some of this stuff, I mean, it's like you look across the board at these judges. It's like you look around. It's like who stood up to DCFS? And, you know, I look at one judge that did. You know, he was removed, you know, from office because he wasn't playing ball, you know. And so, you know, this is what I'm finding is there's collusion here or there's a problem. The monetary incentive has made people go insane, and the system's anti-family, and I'm taking it on, and we're going to make some changes.
Well, you've impressed Jordan Page, and you got to meet with him up there. I imagine he was doing a function. We didn't have much time to talk, but I trust Jordan's his evaluation of the situation and you, and he wants to get involved. And I know being a young father such as he is and a grandfather I am, this is all of importance to us because you do not want the government even to get a piece of paper that's to be filed with your name on the top of it and associated with your children. You just don't. And once that happens, where do you go? And the incentive for them to just never go away. But as you're doing this in Utah, you still have to keep in mind you're dealing with a federal program. You're dealing with money. You're dealing with a big giant pipeline. It's like Vermont or New Hampshire or something saying, you know what? We're not doing your seatbelt laws, you know, screw it and keep your money for the highways. Well, yeah. I guarantee this is right. If you're not doing it exactly the way they want, you don't get no money. And the legislators have to know this.
Well, the good news is this. There are Title IV-B funds that focus on family preservation and can be used in that capacity. And so part of my main goals of the state legislature in this next upcoming session is to, number one, refocus the system through a resolution that the goal of the system should be family preservation where at all possible. And when a child does, in fact, need to be removed, the number one goal at that point should be to place that child with kin. And very rarely should we be looking to go outside of the family. And when they also say kin, they also do include not only blood family members, but very, very close friends of the family. And so I think, number one, we need to refocus our goals, and that is to keep the family together. And then the goal is to refocus how we're funding this process, because the process should be about family preservation. And guess what? Families like people aren't perfect. There are situations where families might need a little bit of help, but that doesn't mean, just because the situation at home isn't perfect, does not mean these people aren't capable of providing a loving, caring home for that child. And so basically what I would like to see happen is a focus on by using the Title IV B funding, preserve the family, and provide in-home family services. And it's crazy when you look at what it costs to provide these in-home family services in comparison with taking the children out of the home, into foster care, and maybe potentially even adopting them out. It is so much more expensive to go through the foster care system and process outside of the home, on top of how you decimate the family and the effect to the parents and the effect to the children by being removed from their home.
The expense part is part of their problem. I mean, it's part of their motivation. I another one I'm reminded of, another family. They have a son, a grown son with a 7-year-old child in California. And he was one of the marijuana growers, and he violated some condition under how he grew his something. So he's in some legal trouble, and because he had a child, boom, they take the child. It's involved, even though it's medicinal marijuana and he just didn't do something right, whatever, boom, they take the kid. And I'm going, so this whole process, once you start, you're dealing with the state in any way, and all of a sudden you open yourself up to this. So yes, I understand how this is a big problem. Now let's go ahead and talk about, you know, some of the instances that you are able to share with us. Give us a story.
Okay. Right before I go into the story real quick, I was just going to make the point is this. In-home family services on an annual basis cost about $1,700 here in the state of Utah. Whereas to take the child out of the home, put them through through foster care, adoption process, whatever it be, $46,000. I mean, I would argue this. States could probably get by on their own budgets, even without federal funding, if they redirected their focus to family preservation and in-home family services, because, number one, it's a hell of a lot cheaper. Number two, you're keeping the family together, which is more positive for the children and for the parents. And then what you're also doing is actually shortening the amount of time, because on average, in-home family services, they might need help for 4 months, whereas in the situation of foster care, the average length's more like a year. I mean, it's like night and day comparison. And so if we can
redirect their focus. But you're always making the case that it's cheaper, better, you know, more efficient, more welfare for the child, and on and on and on and on. And I'm telling you, that's not their goal. That is, hello? You know, that's not what they're looking to do.
Well, I do believe that there's some good legislators here that do want to refocus and preserve the family. And so I am hopeful that we can actually, by changing the system, by moving some things around, we can weed out the bad people in this process and keep and retain the good people that do care about keeping families together and intact.
Yeah, you find good people in government, you let me know. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, fair enough.
Go ahead and tell me one of your stories. I'm just sitting here on the edge of my seat waiting for a good story.
Fair enough. Okay, so the most recent thing that's impacted my life, certainly yesterday was a very difficult day, because this family, Jennifer and Brandon Stark, they actually had their parental rights terminated last week. And yesterday was their final farewell to their four children, ages 6 months old up to 6 years old. They had four beautiful boys. And literally, this family, parental rights terminated. They had a half hour to say goodbye to their four children for life.
Did they keep the children together?
Well, I guess it's really hard to say if they will or not. I mean, they don't really even have a say anymore. They terminate the parental rights, and you know, you have no idea what's going to happen at that point.
What precipitated
this? You'll hear from them. Well, where this all began was about a year ago. DCFS received an anonymous tip that there were drugs in the home. They showed up with a police officer one Saturday morning in the very last day of August of last year. They demanded the parents take a drug test. Now, these parents were aware enough of their rights to say, do you have a warrant? They did not. So DCFS, after looking around the house and the police officer as well, looking a little bit at the children, they left. But then what they did is they came back that same day, took the children without evidence or anything else, just took the children, and basically started the process of claiming, you know, we believe you guys are a flight risk, we're going to take the children, and then proceeded the following day that the parents went and were court-ordered to get a urinalysis as well as a hair follicle drug test.
Okay, because somebody said
that there are drugs in the house.
Well,
now,
as a libertarian, I'm going, there's so many prescription, this, that, whatever. Heck, I'd rather them, you know, smoking marijuana than anything else. But the point is I'm going, what was the physical evidence of neglect or abuse?
No physical evidence or abuse. They had nothing they could say. About the way that the children looked when they came into the home at that point. I mean, the fact of the matter is they came back with a warrant and took those children. I just don't even understand. That is not even justifiable. There was no proof at that point. There was nothing. And so then the parents did obviously, I mean, this is the worst type of coercion. What won't you do? You're going to do everything they say because the threat is if you don't comply, you will never see your children again. And it's the worst type of coercion. So the parents go and take the drug test. Now, the mother is absolutely clean. She's, you know, doesn't use drugs. The father did come back positive. He did test positive for drugs. He had marijuana and meth in his system. So, but once again, it's not a crime to be test positive on a drug test, mind you. But the bottom line is the mother worked. They went ahead and had to concede to, continual drug testing. They probably said – they told me they got drug tests like every other day, literally. And so the mother, they got a court-appointed attorney. She was able to a month or so later after the children were taken, get back custody of the children. But just only her. Basically, they said in her plan that her husband was not able to be in the home, which I don't understand where, they have that ability, being that considering there was no evidence of abuse or neglect on these children. In fact, when the children were taken, the people from the CJC,
CJC, what's CJC?
So basically, you know, the child juvenile court.
Okay.
So basically, individuals there testified on the fact that the children were in fact clean, the children were in fact happy, the children were in fact well-adjusted, they displayed no signs of abuse or neglect. Okay? So we don't have, these aren't like malnourished kids with major behavioral problems, I mean, none of the above. They're all happy, you know, well taken care of kids, they're clean, everything else, not neglected or abused at all. So the attorney did get the children reunified with Jennifer only under the condition Brandon can't be in the home. Then, mind you, she's pregnant. Then we fast forward to the fact that now Brandon finds himself in a situation where he has to pay his family's rent. Now he has to get his own place and pay his own rent. His family's already at poverty level. Then in his plan, they were demanding that he needs to clean up. He needs to, you know, go to drug rehab. The drug rehab they were offering to him, number one, the first drug rehab, I mean, it was like $6,000. I mean, he doesn't have the money to attend that. Then the other thing they were offering him was about $200 a month, which, you know, and now that he's having to pay his own rent and the family's, he couldn't afford to pay that.
So it's extortion racket.
Totally. I mean, basically, you have to pay to play, and that's how this whole thing works. And so basically they didn't like the fact that, you know, he can't afford to tend that, you know, and then so he's out of the home. Then we fast forward to many months later, the wife has her baby on March 15th, brand new baby. Then we, mind you, all along the way, Brandon has to be supporting the family and paying his own rent. In fact, in her own safety plan, it stated, you know, Brandon, he's not allowed to be in the house. You know, if he stops, you know, if he comes to the house, you need to call DCFS or the police, let them know that he's there. You know, all of these types of things, which is so crazy. You know, they think that they can create all these restrictions, but basically people will agree to anything just because of the threat of having their children taken once again. And so basically Brandon stops by unannounced to drop off the rent check. Even before Jennifer sees him, DCFS has just arrived to do a regular check visit, and they see that he's there. He never went into the house. They actually lied and said that he was in the home, and they took the children the very next day, and that was back in May. So the children were then taken. The judge, you know, at that very next hearing, their court-appointed attorney didn't even show up, and so it was at that hearing they coerced the parents once again under duress, basically to add the child, the brand new baby, to their safety plan. Meaning, you know, if you don't follow these, you know, X, Y, and Z, we can take the baby, and under threat and duress, and without an attorney present to even help them understand what they're signing, what they're doing, and they're, of course, they're being threatened because they said, as you said, I don't want to sign without an attorney. Well, if you don't do this, you're not going to be able to see your children. I mean, this is what they do. And basically, part of the plan was that, you know, Jennifer needs to look for a job, which she got assistance in looking for a job. But they also said, you know, she needs to get a driver's license, which, you know, at that point, the local rural town, they only offer those courses when school's in session, because it's very rural. And so at that point, being late May, school's not in session again until the very end of August. And she found herself in a situation where they had their very next hearing come up in August. And, you know, she hadn't completed that, but she had tried to do the other things. And basically the judge said, you know, you haven't done what I've asked you to. And basically at that point, She had actually tried to get her sister so his sister could get custody of the children, and her sister lives in Ohio. And basically, DCFS had promised the family, oh, we'll make it so, you know, the children could be adopted by your sister. They led her to believe that. They basically made that promise to her for those many, many months leading up to it. But it was at that hearing in August, the judge said, when in accordance with the guardian ad litem's, basically, testimony, the guardian ad litem said, well, the children have now been in the custody of a foster family for 2 months. We feel they're bonded with that family, and it would be detrimental to remove them and place them elsewhere, which I find the most insane and sickening part of it all, because here these poor children have been lived with their family their entire life. They've been ripped from their home, placed with strangers, and they're telling me that, you know, they bonded with these foster strangers for 2 months, and that's better than placing them with family.
Now, the foster system is of interest, especially now that we have Michelle Bachmann running for president, and she's always going on about her 20-something foster kids. And was that a foster kid farm? I mean, is she making money on this? Is it a cost?
Absolutely, they do. There's actually a very perverse, I think, incentive there as well, because the foster system does pay, and it pays quite well, depending on where you are and what qualifications or the situation of the case. And so I've seen where you've got for special needs children, states paying out $1,100 a month for a foster care child, and the average, I would say the minimum, they're probably paying, minimum at least just over $300, but most of the places I'm seeing, they're paying out about $500 a month per child. And so you actually attract a lot of people that I don't think they're not doing this out of the goodness of their heart. You attract a lot of people who do this for the money. And so I think this is very dangerous, because if you look at the statistics surrounding children in custody of DCFS, in essence, in a foster family, the rate of abuse is so much higher for children in the care of foster parents. It's by far skyrockets. It's so much higher than in their own home. I mean, I've seen stats as high as 10 to 1. I mean, they're more likely to be physically abused, sexually abused, and neglected, because I do believe it attracts people who don't do this out of the goodness of their heart. I know some do, and I'm not saying all foster parents are bad. I would never say that. But I will say it does attract individuals who do it for the monetary incentive, which is why one of the bills I'm running, and I'm hoping we will prevail, is to defund it. So parents don't get paid to be foster parents. If you want to do that, it's a charitable act. You want to do this out of the goodness of your heart, you will do it for free.
What is it that you're looking for in the terms of help or advocacy of your advocacy? You know, what's going on there? Are you willing to take it national? Is this not just a state issue where you're at, but everywhere? Are there other organizations nationally that you're looking to copy, emulate, or there isn't one? You know, tell me what your future plans are.
My plans are right now, like I said, is to incorporate kind of more or less a advocacy consultancy by which I can, you know, retain good legal counsel for these parents, give them good advice, get them the assistance they need and the resources they need, and create a network across the nation, because I think that's going to be critical to the ultimate success of this. Because, number one, we do need to do things locally on a state level to have an impact for our families here locally. But more than anything, we could impact this decision in a better way if we had better control over what the federal government was doing. There was a recent bill that came up that was about renewing more funding for this system and this process through 2016. And we, you know, there were a lot of us starting to catch on to it. It was formally Bill 2883, and then they changed it because too many of them was getting some heat on it, changed the bill number, and they got it. They ramrodded it through. I'd never seen, you just don't see bills get passed through the House and Senate as quickly as this bill ended up passing, which just shows, that there is that big monetary incentive that people want and depend on this money. My goal is to set up this system and network here in Utah. If I can assist people in other states, I will. But I'm hoping to set up this advocacy, and then I can help maybe other states set up something similar and pass similar pieces of legislation. Because I think if we have some success here in Utah with types of bills, I would love to reach out to other states where, you know, we can share the bills that we've had success with. I mean, the thing is, the more heads we put together, the better, the more minds on this, the better success we can have, and ultimately, in time, make the changes we need to, and that is to redirect the funds in a more pro-family, more family preservation capacity, and then also to make decisions at the state level that just make a lot more sense, that protect the family, to create more stopgaps, create more safeguards, make it more difficult to terminate parental rights.
Well, so, I know that this is an important issue to a lot of people, and I know it's been, fortunately, I haven't, well, my nephew got caught up in this. You know, he's just, at 13, he's just being a handful. And he got into the system, and man, that is, once you're in, you're in. So we're working our way through that. But I can see that your services are needed. And there are a lot of people here in Arizona that could definitely learn from what you have to offer. So I want to stay in touch. I want to, see how you're doing. And of course, Freedom's Phoenix and this show is always open to you to be able to break some news and get us the information that we need. Darcy Van Orden, O-R-D-E-N. You go on Facebook and just look up Darcy, D-A-R-C-Y, space Van, V-A-N, space O-R-D-E-N. And she's also the chair of the Republican Liberty Caucus in Utah and a member of Campaign for Liberty. Darcy, thanks for coming on. I think you gave us enough to understand that when we look to this issue, we have an ally, and at least somebody that's experienced in this issue and has the ear of some legislators and making progress. I'm glad that you came on. And is there any website or additional information you want to give the audience before we go?
Well, I would say feel free to find my, my public page on Facebook, and feel free to like that. And you can contact me through that. That's probably the best way to get a hold of me, is the Darcy Van Orden public figure, Darcy Van Orden DVO public figure page. And feel free to connect if you have good ideas, legislation you've had success with in your state. If you're an attorney and you want to do some pro bono work and provide assistance, if you want to fund our effort, I mean, really, unfortunately, things come down to money. And for me to retain good counsel that by which I can assist families with their services, if you want to donate, get in contact with me. Or if you have stories you want to share, go ahead and post them on my public figure page. We need to create the awareness, and the only way we're going to have success, passing important pieces of legislation at the state level, to create enough awareness so maybe we can stop in the future federal funding that's perverse, that's focused too much on breaking the family apart. If we create enough awareness, we can help start to change this issue and point it back in a direction that preserves the family and helps our children.
Thank you, Darcy. And one thing I failed to mention is that you got a BS in criminal psychology from George Mason University. So, she knows how to spell. So this, I'm sorry.
I said, I do.
So this is, to have someone with some education behind the advocacy and dealing with people and the actual writing of legislation. It's not required that you have a quality education, but it doesn't hurt. Thanks for coming on, Darcy. I appreciate you doing this. And we'll go ahead and stay in touch. When you got news that you think we'd be interested in, please let us know about it, would you?
Absolutely. And I appreciate you giving me the time today, because this issue is so important. People need to be made aware. And I'm hoping that we can provide some help in the lives of some families.
Well, I know a lot of people need it. Thanks for listening to Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, here in Phoenix, Arizona. To our new friend, Darcy Van Orden, in Utah, trying to make sure that, government's role is limited to the protection of life, liberty, property, and not the focus of ripping families apart. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll be right back with another show before you know it.